Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, I'm Justin Briley. Welcome along to the programme. Unbelievable, where we get Christians and non-Christians talking, but very often Christians and Christians talking as well. It's the dialogue show that helps to get you thinking. Got a really interesting subject today, very much related to recent events in the Middle East. We're talking about Israel, Palestine and the Gaza conflict. Before I introduce my guest for today's show, though, if you want to listen back to previous shows and get hold of some of the features and resources linked to Unbelievable, why not check out the all-new website? That's at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable, and a chance to avail yourself also of the ordering form for the Unbelievable Conference DVD. We had an excellent day about just over a month ago now in Westminster Central Hall in London with a variety of speakers on how to defend the Christian faith, how to present your faith in an engaging way. And if you want to watch that and hear the audio from it as well, it's all available to pre-order from the website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD. Well, I've promised you another interesting show. Last week, you may remember, we were talking economics, world poverty, with Wayne Grudem and my other guest, who was Richard Glover from Australia. Well, we're continuing, as it were, assessing political, sociological, economic kind of themes as we go into today's programme, as we look at the ongoing Israel-Palestine conflict. Let me introduce today's guest for you. You're unbelievable. Well, it's a pleasure to be joined in the studio today by Dr. Salim Munaya. He's a Palestinian Christian. He is the director of Musalaha. It's a charity focused on trying to bring reconciliation between young Jews and Arabs. He's also a lecturer at Bethlehem Bible College. He's the author of Through My Enemy's Eyes and is currently in the UK with its co-author, Lisa Loden, who's a Messianic Jew. We'll be hearing more about that book as we meet Salim in a moment's time. My other guest is Steve Maltz, a Messianic Jewish Christian. He's the author of numerous books, the latest being God's Blueprint, looking at the Old Testament. Well, he runs the Yeshua Explored website, loads of articles there, and that can be found at premier.org.uk/Yeshua Explored. A very good afternoon to you both, gentlemen. Thank you for joining me on the programme today. Great to have you here. Salim, let's find out a bit about you, first of all. I know that you've been into our studios before in the past. We haven't had you here on Unbelievable before, though. A little of your background. Did you grow up within a Christian context?
Yes. I am a Palestinian Christian. My parents are Greek Orthodox, part of the indigenous Christian community in the land. We see ourselves the continuation of Christian presence in the land since the time of Pentecost. I'm born in the city of Lydda. Lydda is a very famous city because in Lydda there is a tomb of St. George, the patron of England, the modern, or what we say modern, the Middle East, the 17th century church, been helped built by my family. And so we are very much rooted in the land. And in 1948, the city of Lydda got conquered by the Israeli army, and the city of Lydda experienced what we Palestinians call a Nakba, that the people of the city of Lida, Muslims and Christians, by force has been forced out of the city. It's one of the dark, painful story in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. My parents, with other 200 Christians that found refuge in the church, were able to stay in the city, but they were not allowed to go back to their homes.
Right.
So I grew up post-traumatic era from 1948. Grew up in a mixed community of Jews, Muslims, and Christians. At home, we spoke Arabic. I went to Christian school, schooled most of the kids Muslims. I went to Jewish high school, and during my time in the Jewish high school, I went through identity search, asking many, many questions. In that process, I found Jesus.
Goodness.
In a mixed group of Jews and Palestinians, in a home group.
So it's a really interesting and eclectic sort of history that you've had personally, and very much interwoven, obviously, with the history of the area you come from.
It's true.
We're going to be exploring that, obviously, on today's program. But thank you very much for joining
us.
Just a brief introduction as well to you, Steve Maltz. Thanks for joining us. Because both of you gentlemen will be joining me again next week as we continue to talk about the Jewish Jesus, we'll probably get a bit more of your story in full then, Steve, as it relates to that. But just very briefly, are you happy describing yourself, as I introduced you, as a messianic Jewish Christian?
Well, two of those words sort of mean the same thing in the eyes of Messianic and Christian. There's so many labels that, you know, when a Jew becomes a believer, he can either be a Messianic Jew, a completed Jew, a Hebrew Christian, a Christian Jew. I mean, I just call myself a believer.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you don't tend to
disciple of Jesus, good enough for me.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. But we'll go into more detail about your own background and how you came to faith yourself maybe next week as we explore that whole area. But just briefly outline kind of where you see this whole sort of issue in the Middle East. Have you followed it kind of from fairly early on, as far as you're concerned?
Yes. Being a Jew in the diaspora, you can't avoid it, the issue. You can bury your head in the sand, as I did when I was a teenager. But when I became a believer, the Lord really pushed me into my sort of Jewish background a lot more and forced me to confront the issues. And as you introduced me, I'm a writer, and I was struggling to know what to write about. And then the Lord just gave me, I think it was the first Intifada in the 90s, I was in early 2000s. As a result of that, the Lord just gave me a short article that I wrote, which simply was called The Idiot's Guide to the Middle East Conflict. And I did it, and I put it on the internet, and a lot of people liked it, and it became a booklet, and I think it sold like 10,000 copies all over the world. So it's given me a perspective of what's going on. I think my perspective has probably changed a little bit since then, because it's not all cut and dry.
No.
You know, there are two, you know, alternative viewpoints. But I would like to say the viewpoint, as a Christian, this is a Christian station, and, you know, things have to be looked at through spiritual eyes, and we tend to get deflected into politics and sociology and other things, but, you know, the Lord's work, you know, we have to have put the Lord at the centre.
Yeah, we'll certainly come into that as we go through. I mean, this is a protracted and very difficult history that we're talking about when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I don't claim to be in any way an expert on this, Salim, but perhaps you could, as briefly as you can, obviously, for what is, you know, 100 years more, you know, history, perhaps give us a sense of the timeline and how we arrive at this situation today in the summer of 2014 with this terrible situation we've all been witnessing on our TV screens.
Yeah, no doubt Steve is right. That's right, Steve is right. This is one of the most difficult, painful issues, our historical narrative. The Israeli-Palestinian historical narrative is the most competitive, bitterly competitive, uncompromising narrative. And let me try in very short time to talk about that. The roots of this conflict is coming through 100 years ago, the break of the big empires, the rise of nationalism, where different people group wanted to have nation state. The Jewish people want to become a nation state. was the beginning of Palestinian nationalism. Mm. In Europe, you have anti-Semitic ideology and mistreatment of the Jews that led to the formation of the Zionist movement, the national movement of the Jewish people, that they wanted to have a safe haven where they develop the new Jewish man. It's not the diaspora Jew. They were thinking one time going to Uganda, Argentina. Then they linked themselves with the British Empire at the crown at that time. And the crown at that time looked in the Middle East was the breakdown of the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, who is going to win the biggest piece of the land of the Middle East? Is it France? Is it Britain? Mm-hmm. Is Russia? Is German? Oil has been discovered. The Suez Canal lead to India, the most important aspect of the crown empire at that time. Arab nationalism beginning to evolve in the Middle East. The breakdown of the Islamic caliphate with the Sultan saying, I'm not anymore the leader of Islam. So you lose the centrality of Islam at that time. So you have those factors. Britain also, at that time, there was a rise of theology. We call it dispensationalism, a form of Christian Zionism that we have today, like Lord Balfour, Lord George, that saw that establishing homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine will enhance the second coming of Jesus. It was interest, political interest. Let's have Jewish Western crown favor people in the land, in the Jews, in order to exert influence in the Middle East. As a response to all of that, you have the First World War, conquering of the Middle East, promise to the Jews through the Balfour Declaration, promise to the Arabs through MacMahon document. Most people don't know that the British also promised the Arabs to have their MacMahon document, to have their empire with Damascus, its capital, and only Lebanon for the Christian.
Right.
And then they took the map of the Middle East to a gentleman in Paris, Sykes and Picot, and they divided the Middle East between themselves.
Yeah.
And what we see right now in Syria and Iraq is a breakdown of that agreement, Sykes-Picot. It wasn't Iraq. It was three districts, Shia, Sunni, and Kurds.
Yeah.
And as a response to modernity, westernization, globalization, the formation of the State of Israel as perceived by the Arabs and the Muslims as imperial force in the Middle East, you have the rise of Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah. It's. I mean, you've spelled out a whole variety of things. I mean, many people obviously think of that particular date, 1948, and the creation of the State of Israel. It's not as simple as that, though.
It's not. It started 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was the desperate situation of the Jews in Eastern Europe. Mm. 2.5 million Jews want to get out of Ukraine, Russia, Poland. They want to go to the West, England and America. The West closed its gates. It's like having 25 million Somali Muslims coming to the West. We don't want them.
Yeah.
They're different.
I mean, obviously, since 1948, there's been a variety of wars of greater or lesser
but
degree.
The conflict did not start in 1948. The conflict started before the First World War.
Sure. No, absolutely. I mean, in terms of where we're at now, obviously,
it's now what you have. You have the indigenous people, the Palestinian people that lived in the land, a different level of consciousness of nationalism, suddenly dealing with a group of people coming from outside want to establish a state in their land, and they call it the Jewish state.
Mm.
And one saying, this my homeland promised to the fathers. And I said, we're living there for 2,000 years. So you have two groups of people competing on the same piece of land.
Yeah. Is that kind of the way you read the history as well, Steve?
In a sense, yeah. I certainly don't deny that that your family and many Palestinians can trace their lineage right back to biblical times. But I'd also suggest that Jews had always lived in the land, not always in the majority. There had always been a Jewish presence in the land, in Jerusalem, in Safed, in many places for study and just for general living. Mm. But I agree that virtually everything that yeah. was said about what happened in the 19th century, mm-hmm. and it as a result of the pogroms, in its anti-Semitism drew, you know, the Jews had to go somewhere.
I even support your point of view. Yes, the Jews lived in the land, but not in the sense of nationalism. No, nationalism was a modern concept.
I mean, that was a more recent thing.
But I just want to even to tell you that more than that, many Jews that lived in the land after the destruction of the Second Temple, some of them become Christians, so spoke Aramaic, like some of the old churches in the land are speaking Hebrew, Aramaic Hebrew, and they are the Greek Orthodox of today. And some villages, Muslim villages, are Jewish.
So are you saying you think you have Jewish blood in you then?
Why not? I mean, we all mixed from Adam. So there's some Palestinian. They are, you know, your family Gidon, your family Hananiah in Bethlehem. At 200 years ago, there is a whole village near Hebron that's known to be Jewish. Yeah. That they, through the centuries, they become Muslim. Yeah. Matter of fact, after 7th century, more Jews turned to Islam than to Byzantine Christianity.
We'll come back into this. So we've had a really good introduction there to some of the background issues and both of you. If you're listening and you'd like to perhaps give your thoughts on this whole area, and perhaps particularly in light of the recent conflict in Gaza, then do get in touch. We'd be interested to hear from you as well. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also, of course, find us online. If you go to the website, you can find the links to the Facebook and Twitter pages as well. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And you can find today's programme links to my guests. They are today Steve Maltz and Dr. Salim Munaya.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We're talking today about Israel, Palestine and the Gaza conflict. We're exploring the history and the solutions, looking at the biblical and historical roots of this conflict and what hope there is for peace. Hundreds of people, perhaps numbering into the thousands, really, this summer have been killed, certainly thousands injured. Many people obviously looking on have their views as to who's to blame, where the, as it were, blame lies in terms of the casualties and so on. Obviously, both sides feel very much that their cause has to be defended at some level. Steve, for you, how much of this does come down to, as a messianic Christian, the right of Jews to live in a certain, you know, prescribed area of land, and how much of that is tied into this, the fact that the, was there a fulfillment of prophecy in any sense in 1948, as far as you're concerned?
As far as I'm concerned, yes. Not every Jew would agree with that, because you have to, by saying yes, you're implying that you believe in the Bible. We have to go back to Genesis 12, verse 1, you know, Abraham, who was from Ur, who wasn't Jewish, was called to the land, and God gave him sort of the title deeds to the land as a everlasting covenant, as part of the everlasting covenant. Now, obviously, this is an issue of great debate, and I'm up against the university professor here, so I'm not going to. Just to say that is the origin. That's the spiritual origins of, and it was later on in Genesis 17 and various other places. The land was sort of described in more detail, exactly what was meant, the land of Canaan and then the surrounding. So that was seen as the promise of the land. And that's for ever since, certainly since the 19th century, not so much for Jews in a sense, but from Christians, certainly in England, many of the top names in English Christianity, like Wilberforce and Shaftesbury and plenty of others, were Christian Zionists.
Sure. Yeah,
and they were looking at their Bible and saying, now is the time for Jews to come back to their biblical homeland. And there's an Anglican effort to help them, and also from other European countries. So the Jews just want to live in peace, basically. And let's face it, you know, they never have lived in peace outside the land. Not much peace inside the land either.
I mean, in terms of the actual casualties we've seen in terms of the recent conflict, a lot of people are saying, but they're, you know, the reaction, obviously, they're responding, they're saying we've got to defend ourselves against Hamas's rockets and so on. Yeah. But a lot of the international community is saying the response is disproportionate when you look at the casualties.
Absolutely.
What's your take on this?
I mean, without wanting to go into sort of, you know, cliches in a sense, the aspect is that the Israelis are so interested in protecting each one of their own people that they build the Iron Dome. Mm. They make sure that casualties on their side are always going to be low. Mm. But as it seems, Hamas, we're not talking about, I'm not, you know, for me, it's not Israel-Palestine, it's Israel versus Hamas, which is nothing, for me, nothing to do with the Palestinians, it's to do with a terrorist organisation. And as such, they, not only were they purposely aiming their rockets at civilian populations, but also hiding their rocket launchers among their own civilian population. So, you know, I don't really want to go into facts and figures of, but all I know is that the Israelis have done as much as they can to minimise the damage, but there are always going to be problems if there is a rocket launcher in a hospital or in a mosque.
Yeah.
You know, that's a problem.
I mean, let's go back to this issue of whether there is a biblical case for the state of Israel, first of all, Salim. Where do you land on this particular issue?
Oh, this is a huge debate, and most of the answers are very simplistic and not really dealing with that properly. And we have published a book that I and Lisa Lodin, as Messianic Jews, we published that, The Land Cries Out, where we have articles about theology of the land by Palestinian Christians and Messianic Jews and Western Christian. I think it's, with all due respect to Steve, it is this mantra of Genesis chapter 12 doesn't really give really a good biblical understanding of theology of the land. But let me say first that no doubt any Palestinian Christian theologian will tell you there is historical and theological and religious attachment for Jews to the land, but using land language of God gave entitlement and all of that is very dangerous language that lead into violence. And average Palestinian theologians perceive theology of the land begin from Genesis chapter 1 and 2. That in Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God created heaven and earth, and he put Adam and Eve as a guardian. As a result of sin of Adam and Eve, several things that happened. Broken relationship with God, broken relationship between male and female. The first exile happened, we're being kicked out of the garden, and God began the process of restoration. God started the process of restoration, restoring us back to the garden that you see it in the book of Revelation, new earth and new heaven. That's the purpose of God. To the whole earth, the whole creation will be restored by God. And Abraham is the individual that God have given to him two aspects of promises. One that related to specific piece of land, but as Paul is saying, Romans chapter 4, the world. Matter of fact, the language, the Hebrew language that there is in there by Israeli professor Neil Vazana, when we talk about from the river to the sea to the mountain, it's a language of the cosmos of that time, like Americans say, from the sea to the shining sea. That the whole world is being
so you prompt. Don't feel it has to be prescribed as particular geographical boundaries in the Middle East. It's talking about something wider than that.
Both. There is important for the geographical location of the land. The land of promise, the Holy Land, the land that God promised to Abraham, had a very important, significant part in the history of salvation that God worked in the land. But with Jesus, this what God was doing with this land has been universalized, not spiritualized. Has you will be my witnesses from Jerusalem to the end of the earth.
Yeah.
It's from Jerusalem to the end of the earth. God, Jesus said to the Samaritan woman, "You will worship Him in spirit and truth, not in Jerusalem or Mount Gerizim." So Abraham is the father of all nations. He was not only the father of the Jewish people.
Of course.
The promise of Abraham was to, that from him, the one, the seed of Abraham, he is the one that reverses what first Adam did in Romans.
So do you believe on that basis then that Christians who do hold very tightly to the idea of a physical land for the Jews have at some level misunderstood the nature of,
yes,
of what has happened in Jesus then?
Yeah, yes. There is also not only understanding what's happened in Jesus, I think they don't understand the Tanakh, the Old Testament. I'm not saying that, that the relationship between the children of Israel and the land is connected in a covenant. There is a covenant where you have God, people, and land that connected in a covenant. And this covenant that God has, like marriage covenant, there is a faithfulness factor that plays there.
Let's have a quick response, Steve, just two minutes and we'll go to our break.
First, the idea of the Jews coming back to the land and fulfilling the promises, the literal promises that I would read from my reading of the Bible, doesn't preclude other people living in the land. It doesn't... You know, Jews, okay, then they are tenants of the land. They're not owners of the land. It doesn't mean that they can't live in peace with Palestinians or any other indigenous people. So that's the first point, is that it's... I never read that as being an exclusively Jewish claim. And the other thing is, following on from the biblical exposition, obviously, in 2 minutes we can't answer. But all we have to say, biblical interpretation is something that has grown over the last 2,000 years, and you really need to know, mindsets that lie behind certain ways of reading what I would see as literal text. So I would say that Selim will be spiritualizing a lot, not just Old Testament, but from the New Testament as well.
Don't say what I am doing.
Just from my point of view.
Literal is very, what literal? Jesus said, I am the door, so Jesus is the door. No, I'm not. And this is, I'm very weary of literal futuristic reading.
Absolutely. You can go too far.
Most of Messianic Jews, Christian Zionists, reading the scripture, literally futuristic, and losing the context of what has been written. And to qualify us differently is not
I'll let Steve come back in a moment's time. We are going to go to a quick break and we'll continue this discussion. If you like, the two guests joining me today on Unbelievable, represent in some way the two positions that exist in the Israel and Palestine conflict. But we're here to have a dialogue and to have a fruitful discussion. We're not here for conflict. And we hope that in listening, you'll be able to yourself understand some of the background to this troubled history of Gaza. So we're going to be continuing this programme in a moment's time. My guest today, Dr. Selim Munaya, he's a Palestinian Christian, director of Musalaha and author of Through My Enemy's Eyes, which he mentioned. He's co-authored with a Messianic Jew, Lisa Loden. Steve Maltz is a Messianic Jewish Christian himself and author of numerous books. And we're going to be hearing from them both again as we continue today's discussion here on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest magazine, 100 Years On, find out how Christians responded when the world went to war. Meet the Baroness facing down dictators and freeing slaves. Ryan Bell talks to us about his experiment living as an atheist for a year. And find out why gaming phenomenon Minecraft has captured the creative spark of both adults and children. Plus news, reviews and all your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. Unbelievable is part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon with me, Justin Brierley. And don't forget that later on today, you can hear the profile interview. Every week we hear from a Christian in some walk of life or faith who's a leader in their field, be it sports, acting, politics, media or something else. That's between 4 and 5 today here on Premier Christian Radio. Later on today's show, we're going to hear some of your feedback as well. A really interesting debate last week, as I mentioned earlier, between Dr. Wayne Grudem. He's a well-known, fairly conservative theologian out in the States, and he was talking about his new book, The Poverty of Nations. I was about to say The Wealth of Nations, but it's a play on the title, of course, of that famous book, talking about solutions to world poverty. And again, a really interesting discussion had last week on that with Australian theologian and economist Richard Glover. They certainly didn't see eye to eye on everything, but that's the idea of this show. We get you thinking. Two different perspectives join me every week. So some of your thoughts on that later on in today's programme. Today, though, we're talking to Dr. Salim Manoia. He's a Palestinian Christian and director of Musalaha, and he lectures at Bethlehem Bible College. But the charity he's director of is trying to bring reconciliation between young Jews and Arabs. Well, today also joining us is Steve Maltz. He's a Messianic Jew. He's author of a number of books, including God's Blueprint, which is a look at the Old Testament. If you want more information about Steve, go to his own webpage, his blog at Yeshua Explored, if you can find that on the Premier website. Talking about Israel, Palestine and the Gaza conflict, never an easy thing to cover in soundbites, and even an hour won't do it justice. But we were starting to sort of uncover some of the, as it were, differences in opinion, obviously, between you both on the way you interpret scripture, the Old Testament, and the promises there regarding the Jewish people and Abraham and so on. A lot of this, of course, essentially is the background to the kind of conflict we see
today.
No,
I disagree.
You disagree with that?
Yeah, I disagree. I think the conflict is political. It's two ethnic groups are fighting to exert or to affirm themselves as a nation, to have a place. And religion and theology come later. The root of the conflict doesn't start with theology.
Mm-hmm.
It is a Western Christian framework of framing the conflict as theological. No, it is desperate people in Europe trying to have safe haven and home, and people that lived in the land, they want at the same time to have a home and land. That is the root of the conflict.
Yeah.
Trying to frame it theologically, that is a mistake. Okay. That adds a problem. And by the way, you can go and read a lot of information about what we do at musalaha.org in our website. And what we have found out in our work of reconciliation is that the biggest obstacle for our both people is the heart issue, not the heart issue, the hatred, the enmity between the people, and the way and the fact that we demonize each other, that both communities in our identity have embraced victimization mentality because the Holocaust, the Shoah, and the Nakba. And as a result, we're unable to reach out to embrace each other. So our historical narratives at core of our identity is bigger problems than theology.
Do you agree with that, Steve?
Yeah, and I'd certainly, going back to your historical assessment, so much of it lay at the hands of the British government back in the 1920s and before that, carving up of the land and just creating this sort of sociological problem. But certainly in terms of we're meant to be brothers, we go right back to Ishmael to Esau and Jacob, and and looking at the I'd always look at it from a spiritual conflict, and I'd say, if you believe in God, you have to believe in an enemy, and the enemy wants Jews and Palestinians not to get on, because we ought to get on. We're brother nations that we ought to be living together. But when you see what has happened, and you can see
It's easier to understand where this hatred comes from, though, when one side feels that they're literally being bombed to death and the other side equally feels that their own safety is under threat on a daily basis. How on earth do you begin to even talk about reconciliation when these two neighbouring parties
are very difficult?
In this way?
And from my perspective and from the information I get, we see a lot of information, certainly in the Palestinian territories, of how Jews are vilified, and you know, in the textbooks, and the way, you know, the whole enemy scenario is built up. And for us, we have to look through 2,000 years of history in Christian Europe, and to see the Jews have been vilified. You know,
do you
for their
think
whole
then
history.
That on average? The way that the average Muslim Arab feels about Jewish people is more than just we want our home and land. It's actually there is a purpose of actually eliminating the Jewish people.
Hamas in their initial documents says we're there to eliminate Israel.
They're committed to the
utter destruction. So when you look at the Gaza conflict, it's not Jew-Palestinian, it's not Israel-Palestine, it's Israel wanted to live against...
But how much of that is shared by the general population, do you think? I mean, do you think that the Islamic population, as it were, of Gaza is actually committed in that sense, or do they simply want...
Well, it's a terror group, isn't it? It's a terror group, and, you know, just can you imagine if you were a German living in Nazi Germany, how you couldn't...
That's,
you know,
very dangerous.
I know it's dangerous, but that's our perception. That's my perception.
Okay.
I'd like to hear the other point of view.
First of all, as a Palestinian Christian and also Israeli citizen, I am against the ideology of Hamas and the way Hamas is going about to fulfill their ideology. And I'm not coming to defend them. So this is a very uncomfortable situation I am in, because I don't want to defend Hamas. That's one thing. Basically, Hamas is Islamic Brotherhood organization that doesn't believe that any political sovereignty entity can exist in the Holy Land, neither Christians or Jewish. And as a result, they're not coming to eliminate the Jewish people, as some that is the theological things. Like the Nazis wanted to kill every Jew. The classical Islamic ideology doesn't believe in the right of Christian or Jewish any sovereignty in the Middle East. That's a very important distinction that we have. The language we use, we have to be careful, because the language we use is leading to hate of Muslims, dehumanizing Muslims, and demonizing Muslims. Even in the question that you were saying, it was leading to that.
Yeah.
And that's very dangerous language and questions the way we're doing it. And because hatred, there are more Muslims are being killed in Europe because there are Muslims than Jews being killed in Europe in recent years. Sure. So by white supremacy groups and all over. So we have to be careful. I'm not saying there is no challenge and danger from radical Islam. My problem, how we are responding to that challenge. And we have ideology that I'm very much strong against it. But also we have ideology among national, religious, Jewish political parties that doesn't believe in the right of the Palestinian for a state. They believe the whole Zionism, that what it used to be, believe in a state for the Jewish people, how much we can have in Palestine. Well, historically, like it or don't like it, it was on the expense of the Palestinian. The suffering of the Jews in Europe, who paid ultimately in the end, very simplistically, the Palestinian people, not the people that prosecuted the Jews in Europe. And concerning hatred exists in both sides. There are a lot of studies have been done about educational books, text in both the Palestinian and the Israeli. And sadly to say, in both community, our text mainly ignores the existence of the other side. My kids go to Israeli Jewish schools, and the map of Israel doesn't recognize Palestinian territory. You go to the West Bank, and there is a map equivalent written Palestine and not Israel. Both community in the text, I really encourage you very much to look into academic, reliable sources that have checked the textbook in both communities are problematic. Sadly to say, and this is really problematic for me, it doesn't help the Palestinian people, that certain Islamic radical group have embraced some of the old anti-Semitic rhetoric. Same time, I listen to Christians, I listen to Jews. The language they talk about Arabs, Palestinian, and Muslim is very disturbing too. And we have to be careful. And I am challenging both community. I'm challenging my community in your struggle with the Jewish people. Embracing European anti-Semitism is doesn't going to help you. It's going to destroy all of us. And that is a disease. Racism is a disease. If it's racism toward the Jewish people as anti-Semitism, if it's racism toward Arab and Muslim, it is destructive. If there is a danger, Jesus in the Sermon of the Mount have taught us how to respond to violence, to evil in the world. And what we do, we're not responding to it.
Do you want to respond quickly? And then I'd like to come back and talk about how you are seeing the green shoots, perhaps, of reconciliation in your own experience.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that's important. But yeah, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously have our own historical perspectives. And you know, for me, the saddest thing of the whole thing is has always been the attitude of the church to the Jewish people. The fact that anti-Semitism throughout history is well known and well documented. And the worst anti-Semitism was under Christian rule, not Muslim rule. Which is very ironic when you look at today. And we still see it. You know, people from my, you know, obviously, you know, your perspective is living in as a Palestinian in Israel. My perspective is an English Jew living as a Christian in the UK. I'm just saying this hatred and this
It strikes me, though, that if you took a sort of a survey today of the, especially the evangelical churches, as it were, where they side most of the time. There's obviously a very strongly pro-Jewish lobby in America, especially.
In America, it's interesting.
And that has obviously provided a great deal of the fact that America has been so supportive of Israel when it has come to
and
the
Jewish lobby in New York.
I understand what you're saying historically, but today it doesn't feel like the church is anti-Semitic in that
sense. Well, there is... someone's done a survey. In fact, someone from, let's say, the other side, there's an organisation, who work in the Middle East, and they've done the survey, and it, in proportion terms, twice as many American Christians are pro-Israel than English Christians.
Right.
So in other words, English Christians tend to side towards Palestinians,
right,
and American Christians tend to side towards the Jews. That is.
But that's different than anti-Semitism, don't you think so, Steve?
No,
this is a dangerous language. I understand.
I'm not saying they're all anti-Semitic.
I do understand. I visit the Bergen-Belsen. Yeah. I studied the Shoah. I do understand your history, your pain, and your fear of Western Christian society. I do agree with you fully. And I stand with you and I speak out. I'm weary of those pro-Palestinian that they are anti-Semitic because they don't like Arab either. Yeah. Matter of fact, the Western, I will not say the church, anti-Semitism, because when I grew up in Greek Orthodox Church, my priest never taught me to hate Jews or to have position about Jews because they killed the Son of God. Right. So we have to qualify that. There is a certain European church Christian attitude to Jews.
It's a Western thing. It's not an Eastern thing.
They have their attitude. Yeah. You can ask the question. Their attitude toward Arab Christian, Eastern Christians, and Muslims. But let's talk about it. And I agree with that point. In a recent poll in the state, the people that by all communities, the people that were kind of perceived as the most best is the Jews. The people that were the least were the Muslims. And I'm coming to say, in certain countries, the attitude toward Muslim is worse than the attitude toward Jews. There are people anti-Semitic. There are Islamic anti-Semitic attitude that it is, but it is not like what it used to be. There are many groups in the churches, like myself and other groups, that we combat and attack and speak against anti-Semitic. There is an issue. This is where you will agree with me. The attitude of Christians in England and Britain is you cannot help it. You cannot help it. You have, since 1967, Matter of fact, 1948 issues a Palestinian people that Britain hold certain level of responsibility has not been resolved. Mm-hmm. After 67, with the occupation, there is more and more awareness of the Palestinian situation, Palestinian Christian situation. People are critical of the policy of the State of Israel. Not only Christian Britain, even Israeli Jews that live in Israel are critical. They are fearful. Mm. This is very key things for you. Let me just finish that and I'll stop. They are fearful that in modern time the Jewish people have a state and power, the sixth or the fifth strongest country in military in the world, strong economy. The moral and ethical that we have learned through history from the Jewish people being compromised by the occupation. And this is not good for the Jews. It's not good for the Jews to control other people. I'm not talking about defense. Israel has the right to defend itself. Okay. But Israel at the same time cannot continue control other people and not enabling them to live a normal life.
And by the control, you speak also of the blockade. And
oh, yes, the blockades and the siege and all of that. Yeah. It doesn't justify how Hamas is doing. But the people of Gaza, you know, most of them by recent poll before their last, they were very anti-Hamas. But they say, we need to live. We are under siege.
But you don't...
If you put yourself on
their
foot...
Would you term this...
The siege
and the blockade
is not a total... Obviously, it's not a total... blockade because food does get in, but that blockade would end
the blockade started before Hamas. The blockade was before.
Well, from what I've heard, it's the sea.
That's from all corners.
Anyway, I'm not going to talk about it. From my point of view, let's say I was a Martian visiting the world, and I'm looking at the geography of the world, and I see this Middle East, and I see one country that has 0.5% of the Middle East. 99.5% of the rest are, to say, Arab or stroke Muslim countries, and yet this little country, over the last, I think up to 1970, since 1948, has had virtually 2/3 of all UN rulings against it. You know, every UN ruling against any country, 2/3 would have been against Israel. Yet it's 1% or under that of the whole land mass. Mm. And the big issue is of that 1% of the way it's responding to the third of its number within its own land, where anyone from outside would say, then why aren't these other countries who are from the same ethnic groups, why don't they help out? Rather than letting these people fester,
because they're
in
not
hatred.
The same ethnic group.
One question I'd love to ask is why didn't Jordan help to relocate the Palestinians and integrate them into society?
Oh yeah, 80% of the Jordanian population are Palestinian. Your question is answered very easy. 80% of the population of Jordan are Palestinian, and they are integrated into society. Other state was not as nice, but there is. But Steve, this is a siege mentality that we blocked. Both our people blocked this. Yeah. There is here, it's Arabs. Not all Anglo-Saxons are English. Mm. They're Canadian. They're American. Mm. The fact that you have 10 cars doesn't give me the right to steal one of your cars if you were one ethnic group. The issue that you have is with the Palestinian people. You have peace with Jordan. The Jordanian army intelligence work with the Israeli. Jordan is not supportive of Hamas. In the current situation, the people that are being the most isolated are the Palestinian, Hamas. Egypt is with Israel. Saudi Arabia with Israel. The PLO with Israel. Jordan with Israel. And
so why can't they talk Hamas round?
Just let me finish. And you have a situation that America and Western European nation are with Israel, You see, this is different perception. Your perception, the world against us, the Palestinian perception, the world against us, because this is the victimization mentality that we do have. But in reality, it doesn't, you know, it's not like this. The issue is, as long we don't deal with the fundamental issue of the conflict, we're not going to have a solution. Mm. From my point of view, my understanding, my personal opinion is that until the 70s, the Arab world did not accept Israel. That certain country wanted to see Israel as a state be destroyed, no doubt about it. But since the year 2000, you have the Arab Initiative, all the Arab countries willing to do peace with Israel with a two-state solution. What I see that Netanyahu, as a prime minister of Israel, my prime minister, is against two-state solution. He's continued to build settlement in the West Bank, moving Palestinians from the Jordan Valley agriculture, and that increase the power of Hamas and not Fatah that want two-state solution. Fatah want to have two-state solution. Maybe we disagree about exactly what it's mean, two-state solution. But you have people saying, let's divide the land between us and come.
And so effectively Israel's attitude has reinforce the hand of Hamas,
because sadly to say,
it's had that kind of effect. I mean, we'll come back to you, Steve, and we'll just again remind those listening that if you'd like to perhaps give your thoughts on this, I'm very willing to hear whichever side of this debate you stand on, then do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also tweet me at unbelievablejb. I'm sure Stephen, do you have a Twitter handle as well, Salim?
Yes, you're on Musalaha.
At Musalaha.
At Musalaha website, great. Musalaha.org, you'll have the Twitter, Facebook and everything.
Well, tell Steve as well, at Yeshua Explored. On Twitter, what you thought of today's discussion, and let me know too at UnbelievableJB if you're using Twitter, Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB as well, of course, for the web page, the Facebook page of the show. All the links and so on available from the website PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We've talked at some length about the issues around the conflict and what you've described as the siege mentality as well, Salim. But I'd be interested, though, from a personal perspective, what you do with Musalaha in terms of bringing together young Jews and Arabs. As I asked earlier, do you see any kind of solution potentially to this ongoing conflict?
I mean, the discussion that we have before us is a typical exercise of that you have when I have Israeli and Palestinian. This is a major disagreement on the historical narrative.
And now we're going to move on.
and this is something we need to talk about. We need to hear each other. We need to listen to each other. But we need to move on, as Steve said. What we, as disciples of Yeshua, of Jesus, as Israeli Jews and Palestinian Christian and Christian from around the world, what we're going to do with that conflict. We cannot let it continue as such. And Musalaha is an organization by a group of Messianic Jews and Palestinian Christians are saying we need to be peacemakers. We need to take responsibility for the conflict. It's not that my Palestinian identity or his Jewish identity, my theological conviction, I'm going to compromise on that about end time, the fate of the Jewish people, or the land, or justice. What I'm coming and saying, what is the future for our children and grandchildren? And it is our responsibility. God have entrusted us to join him in the work of the kingdom of God in order to build bridges between our community, to counter hate by love, to show mercy and compassion to each other, and to bring light into darkness. And that's what we, Musalaha, 25 years ago started. And what we did, we took during the first intifada that started in the late 80s, group of 15 Israelis, some of them after the army, and group of 15 Palestinians were involved in the protest against the occupation, what Palestinians call intifada. We went into the desert. far away from everything, and in the desert, in the footsteps of our father Abraham, where the prophets went, where Jesus went to inaugurate for his ministry as the Messiah, and the temptation to go and deal with us and them, the dehumanization. I do remember very clearly the first day we attempted by worship and prayer and ice-breaking games in the desert to bring people together. Nighttime come, the Israeli went to sleep in one side, the Palestinian went to sleep in another side of the tent, my Jewish colleague and I in the middle, and he jokingly said it was one eye open. It was not working out. The next day in the morning, we brought 15 camels. On each camel, we put Israeli and Palestinian.
You made them spend a saddle together.
We crossed the desert working on together. Camel. And it's not us and them. The conflict is our challenge. Mm. You see, this is the reason why we called the book Through My Enemy Eyes. In the desert, you learn that hatred is like drinking a cup of poison, anticipating your enemy to die. It doesn't work. In the desert, you learn that when you don't forgive, there is a lot of unforgiveness in our culture, in our people. It's like entering a jail and having the key of the door of the jail in our hand and complaining. Our future, the future of the Jewish people, Steve, depends in the relationship to the Palestinian, not with the English. The future of the Palestinian people is not with the Malaysian. Is in their relationship with the Jews. Our future is with our neighbors, and usually our neighbors are our enemy. Our people's future depends on us. And we are running away, your people, my people, running away of sitting together, working out together, and we're trying to find people to triangle into the conflict. It's not going to work out.
I know the neighbors are the problem.
The neighbors are the problem, and we're neighbors. As a matter of fact, it's more than that.
Well, those outside, the British.
It's more than that. We're living in one house. Where we have to learn to share the living room and kitchen. Yeah. We don't need to share our bedroom because you want to keep your the Jewish distinctiveness. And I want you to keep it. I will learn enriched by that. And I want also to keep my identity, our distinctiveness of our identity.
One new man.
We're going to have to just take a quick pause before we go into the final part of today's show. And we'll let you also give your thoughts as well, Steve, on the future for resolution and how these neighbours can live together peaceably and even as brothers, where we at least call ourselves
Christians. We don't have a choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're listening to a fascinating discussion today on the whole area of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Whatever your thoughts on this, be interested to hear from you, and we'll make sure to give out the details for doing that in a moment's time as well. My guest today, Dr. Salim Munaya, he's a Palestinian Christian and director of Musalaha, and Steve Maltz, who's our Messianic Jewish guest on the programme today. We'll be back in a moment's time. Welcome back to the third final part of Unbelievable This Week. But, my guests who joined me on today's programme will be joining me again next week. So let me tell you what's coming up then. I'll be joined by, again, Dr. Salim Munaya and Steve Maltz as we look at the Jewish Jesus and ask, do we need to reclaim the Jewishness of Jesus? The Christian Church, has it divorced Christ from his Jewish culture here in the West? How Jewish was Jesus? Is the Church guilty of anti-Semitism? We've covered some areas of that today in our discussion. But we're going to sort of, as it were, be searching back into the Old Testament and New Testament in next week's programme. So do join us again for that as we continue this series of discussions looking at some of these issues with my guests who represent, as it were, a Jewish and Palestinian perspective on these issues. Later on today, though, here on Premier Christian Radio, you can hear the Profile interview. That's between 4 and 5 o'clock this afternoon. All part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon, hosted by myself. And don't forget that you can also give us your feedback on today's programme. Do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Do check out the website as well if you want to download today's programme, pass it on to someone else, or indeed explore the back catalogue of discussions and debates. And I'll make sure to link to one or two related shows from today's programme. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. unbelievable. So next week, as I mentioned, Dr. Salim Manaya and Steve Maltz join me again. But let's just finish up this week's conversation that we've been talking about, the Gaza conflict, exploring the history and hopefully the solutions as well.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Coming back to you, first of all, Steve, we heard something of the vision there of that Salim has in terms of bringing together both sides, because I guess it's only once we actually look at each other as fellow humans that we start to break down some of these barriers of enmity and hatred and so on. Is that something that you and the, as it were, I hate to use these labels, but the people you represent or are with,
well,
want to see as well. You want to see people sitting down and actually addressing each other directly.
I mean, at the end of the day, I just represent myself and I can't speak for all my people because they're such a very wide, wide, unruly bunch, I must say. But well, basically, at the end of the day, we tend to see each other through eyes of ideas and thoughts rather than relationship. And, you know, as Christians, the end thing is, you know, we're meant to be showing love to each other. And that's how the world will know that we are Christians, through the love that we... And that's not just with your friends and your people you feel familiar with.
Of course, yeah.
You know, we're crossing the waters here. We're, you know, two cultures that have been at odds with each other. But we're more bound by our Saviour than we're... when, you know, then our differences through the political and all the rest of it. So, you know, and it's so easy for us to reverse that and to get bogged down with all the rubbish. So we have to see each other as brothers here.
Yes, I do agree with you fully that, first of all, we are, first of all, being created in God's image. We're brothers and sisters because of the Messiah Jesus did for us on the cross. And I think one of the aspects is very important is that in the scripture we have kings, priests, and prophet. And the church is a priestly role, calling people to God for healing. And the prophet is when the priest doesn't fulfill his job and the king misuses power. Mm-hmm. And this is where I would like to remark, we really don't have all the information concerning why so many civilians has been killed in Gaza. I think we are bombarded by the media that want us to move to this and that. The fact is that a lot of women and children have been killed, and I will not rush to judgment. I will say let's have international war crime that will take our people into task when we violated the law in that area. And we shouldn't be afraid and being critical of our people. If the Palestinian people committed war crime, let's name it. Let's deal with that. If the Israeli did it, let's name it. Let's deal with that, because we don't want a repeat of that, hopefully. We need to be prophetic voice to our people.
Yeah.
I need to be prophetic voice to the Palestinian people. Don't hate the Jews. And the Israeli Jews, because we need to love our enemy as a Christians, because hatred is destructive. And also Israeli Jews, believers in the Messiah, need to see that our prime identity responsibility is the work of the kingdom of God. Mm. Having Palestinian state is not going to solve the Palestinian problem. Having a Jewish state of Israel did not solve the Jewish problem. You see that already from and our solution is not political state or nationalistic state. Our solution need to come through advancing the kingdom of God in our world.
Well, I mean, what a fantastic thing that could be if the two, you know, populations who are most at odds with each other can show unity in Christ.
True.
What a beacon that would be for the world. What, you know, an evangelistic statement that would be.
And we have, you know, it's small, it is a small, it is a hard, but we have right now, as we're talking, I have 10 Israeli, 10 Palestinian, and 10 Norwegian are doing reconciliation in Norway. They're coming to the land. Some of the Israeli just came out of Gaza. Right. That's the soldiers.
Okay.
And some of the Palestinians are from the West Bank.
Yeah.
So it's possible. It's happening. Mm. It's in small scale. And we need to make it bigger. I need you to be advocate for reconciliation, Steve, in your community. I want you to speak to your community and say, like I'm going to, that I am and will continue to speak in my community. You are my brothers and sisters. We are part of the same family. Mm. Our hope, our destiny, our future is connected. We cannot separate that.
We're going to start to draw things to a close. Just final words from you, Steve, as we finish up.
No, I'd like to think we're ended up as brothers.
Yeah.
And you know, we are going to disagree on the nitty-gritty stuff, but at the end of the day, we have a responsibility as Christians to work towards peace.
Amen.
And we must look to the future, not the past.
Amen.
Okay.
Amen. Amen and amen.
We're gonna hear more from these guys next week. Thank you for bringing me on the show today, though, Salim and Steve. If you want to find out more about Salim, why not check out the website of Musalaha, which is the charity he runs, bringing reconciliation between young Jews and Arabs. And of course, there's the book as well, which he's here in the UK to speak of. And in fact, there's going to be a launch of the book Through My Enemy's Eyes on the 26th of September at Coventry Cathedral. So do go online to check that out if you want to get along. You'd be very welcome. That'll be along with Lisa Loden, the Messianic Jew who co-authored that book with you, Salim. Steve, you've got lots and lots of books. You seem to produce two or three a year. But the latest is God's Blueprint. So that's available, I guess, from Yeshua Explored, where people can find out more.
Yeah.
Great stuff. So premier.org.uk/
Yeah, they'll find it through that.
Great.
Yeah.
And we'll see you both next week.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you for joining me on the programme.
Yeah,
and I hope you've enjoyed today's programme. And if you want to get in touch, well, again, the details for doing that in just a moment's time as we hear some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming here on Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, as ever, there is a bulging mailbag of correspondence from previous week's programming. And if you want to get in touch about anything you heard on today's programme, as I say, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the Gaza conflict, both the history and any possible solutions. So do get in touch, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget, we're available on Twitter, Facebook and so on, at UnbelievableJB, the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. You can find those links and links to the guests who joined me on today's programme from the Unbelievable webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And lots of people appreciating the new layout of the website. It's a lot more visually engaging. It's a bit easier to find your way around. And we're trying to add more features as we go along to the website. So do go and check that out if you get the chance. Here's an email that came in from Sarah, who said, "Good morning. I have some feedback regarding the Unbelievable conference, which I attended recently. It was excellent. All the speakers were masterful. A suggestion for next year, a seminar on how to deal with false doctrine within the Christian church itself. I deal with Anglicans who doubt the existence of Satan and the truth of the resurrection or divine nature of Jesus than I do with flat-out atheists. Addressing false doctrine among Christians would be a useful avenue of discussion. Thank you again for an excellent conference." Glad you enjoyed it, Sarah. Obviously, plans are in motion for what we'll do next year, and we'll certainly put that sort of stuff into the melting pot of possible ideas. Thanks very much also to John, who got in touch to say, "Did you catch the news about the new atheist TV channel in the US? Do you think they'd debate with believers like you have debates with unbelievers?" And John says, "I doubt it. I personally don't think it'll last. Hatred has pretty limited mileage in the media." Well, I must admit, I haven't really had a chance to look at what they're airing on this atheist TV channel, so I'm not really in a position to speak about it. But, we'll see, I suppose, whether there's enough interest to warrant an atheist TV channel all of its own. Let's go to some of your feedback to the Unbelievers movie. And we had last week, of course, the debate on
economics and so on. I'm actually going to leave those responses till next week's programme. That was between Wayne Grudem and Richard Glover, because we've had a lot of those, and I'll kind of give them a special airing next week. But we've also had a lot of responses to the Unbelievers movie. Now, this was a discussion between Graham Veal, our Christian guest, and Gus Holwerder, who's the producer of the Unbelievers movie, which features Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss on a world book tour speaking to packed out audiences of skeptics and so on. Lots of you wanting to get in touch about that show, in which they squared off on the issues of science and faith and whether, as it were, atheism has a mileage as a sort of the rock god kind of tour thing that's represented in that movie. Here's Joshua Black in Denver, Colorado. It says, regarding the Unbelievers movie, I enjoyed the topic immensely. There was one idea from a movie clip that Gus and Graham skipped over. I was hoping they'd come back to it. Dawkins seemed to imply that a growth in scientific knowledge would inevitably lead to atheism. He chided the American Congress for having degrees, yet not endorsing atheism wholeheartedly. However, I don't see how science, which is the study of the natural world, can alone say anything positive or negative about a supernatural claim, which atheism certainly is. Only when science is paired to a philosophical or theological worldview is it able to lend support or condemnation to claims those worldviews make. Indeed, Christians like John Lennox, William Lane Craig, pair Christianity to science with great success. It appears Dawkins is pairing his atheism with science, then chastising anyone who has scientific knowledge for not adopting his same presupposed worldview. On a different note, I heard during this week's podcast you read out a scathing email from a critic calling themselves S. Well, in contrast to S's opinion, I want to offer my heartfelt compliments to you and your show. I don't find you a weak Christian in the slightest. Due to the format of your show, you regularly hear non-Christians present their arguments, probably more often than the rest of us Christians. You've listened to disagreements to our faith from every angle, and it takes significant courage to put one's own faith on the line regularly like that. And despite that, you seem to remain a committed Christian, certainly not a weak faith in my view. I'm addicted to your show. I find whenever I listen to one podcast, I write down 2 to 3 more from the back catalogue that I want to hear. Thank you, Joshua. Very kind of you to say those words towards the end of your email. Here's Ricky. And this is Ricky in Edinburgh, but the not an atheist Ricky from Edinburgh. Just making that absolutely clear. We know we had a misunderstanding last year about whether you were a believer or not, Ricky. But this is Ricky, not an atheist, says, listening to the two recent shows with Graham Veal on, I notice he commits the same logical fallacy in both, the so-called genetic fallacy. In last week's show, he asserted that there could not be a conflict between science and Christianity because aspects of modern science emerged out of Christian thinking or were initially proposed by Christians. Well, that's a pure case of genetic fallacy. He made similar comments in the earlier show. And just to give those who may be not familiar with what a genetic fallacy is, it's the idea that because you can show where something came from, then you can show that whether it is true or false or something. And that doesn't necessarily follow. Anyway, you go on to say, also going back a few weeks to the show with Clay Jones and Richard Norman, I found Clay's argument unsatisfactory and also logically fallacious. His reconciling of evil and suffering relies on the counterweight of a blissful eternity after this life, a blissful eternity that he offers no evidence for. Yet at one point he offered a guarantee for. You can find a solution to any finite problem with an infinite but unseen entity or state, but without evidence for the infinite unseen thing, the argument is simply worthless. The unseen infinite solution is actually used by both sides in the origin of everything debate. Why are we here? Because of the unseen and infinite creator God, or because of the unseen and infinite multiverse? Neither answer is satisfying unless the infinite and unseen thing can actually be observed and measured. Anyway, to counter all the negative comments you read out last week, I think you've been a fair and impartial host in most of the debates recently, particularly the theist-atheist debates. Keep up the good work, says Ricky. Thank you, Ricky. I mean, I would say in terms of this issue of did Graham Veal commit the genetic fallacy by saying there couldn't be a conflict between science and Christianity because modern science emerged out of Christian thinking. I'm not sure he quite said that exactly. I think what he was saying was that science owes its birth to Christianity, and therefore this narrative of science having always been in conflict with Christianity is not necessarily the true one. Though I'd imagine Graham would give other reasons, and did give some other reasons, I think, for why you don't have to take it that you know what science shows us is in conflict actually with a God and with Christianity. But anyway, thank you very much for getting in touch and for your comments on both those shows. Here's Grace, who says, Graham, last week I was aching to challenge Gus further on a number of points. Why did he want to suggest that proof of the non-existence of God might be possible? I've heard plenty of atheists rightly concede that this isn't possible. It could always be the case that God is simply hidden to our limited senses and scientific equipment. To suggest that God could be conclusively disproven is unscientific. It seems odd to me that a non-Christian would be keen to show off the rock star lifestyle of celebrity atheists. Why would this encourage viewers of the credibility of their arguments? Surely it does the opposite, if anything. Simply suggests that the atheist movement is driven by hedonism more than a desire for truth. Gus was clearly fixated on the importance and certainty of evolution. Failure to specify that one is referring to macroevolution or evolution of a new species from another, including humans from apes, always makes me sceptical as to how much the person has studied the topic. I wanted desperately to know on what basis he was personally so very certain of evolution from apes and why he feels it is a real problem that it might not be taught in schools. Evolution from apes needs far, far more exploration. It's largely reliant on speculation and theorising rather than evidence, though it has become totally accepted such that no one dare publicly disagree with it, although it is far from conclusively proven. Thank you very much, Grace. Here's an email from Samir from the Antipodes, who says, I appreciate the programme and your efforts at balance. I wanted to address some of the things said during the discussion about the Unbelievers film. The reason I see there's a conflict between religion and science is that I've not seen any scientific hypothesis of what we expect with a God assumption. What tests would be done? What predictions made? What efforts are made to disprove the hypothesis by theists? For example, asking for the bones of Jesus to change your mind as a Christian seems a really trivial thing. Firstly, it begs the question that Jesus existed as described in the Bible. Secondly, that the only reason the bones don't exist means that he rose from the dead. What would Jesus' bones look like? Two X chromosomes? All the talk of probabilities and conjecture shows that the whole point of science, natural philosophy, was missed, which is to test assumptions. Also, the assertion of science being a result of religious belief I find very tenuous, just like the term Christian values implies that these ideas are exclusive to Christians. Consider the work done in ancient Greece, where links between mathematics and the universe and religion were made, then the basis of these ideas for the progress of science and philosophy in the Arab world, and then those ideas flowing back to Europe, as well as the influence from India and the East. I'll stop for now. I find myself wanting to interject many times during your shows. Thank you for making me think and challenging me. Glad you're listening, Samir. Thank you for listening. Dave Kirkland in Moscow, Idaho says, thanks for continuing to put on such a good weekly radio show. I rarely miss one. I enjoy the discussions. I'm wanting to talk about the Unbelievers movie. I haven't seen it yet, only a few clips and sound bites, but I want to watch it in order to hear more directly from Dawkins and Krauss. And I thought Graham was pleasant and respectful, made excellent points during the show with Gus. And I agree with him that the whole narrative of science and faith are incompatible or always at odds is absurd and illogical in the end. Those two areas do not have to clash or cancel each other out. Christians believe that God is an uncaused being of order, design and logic, which does fit well with this universe we observe and live in. As Graham mentioned recently on Stand to Reason, if evolution is the best explanation, it seems we would be surrounded by chaos. And if you take Christianity out, it's very difficult to see how this whole thing started. I agree with that. Evolution is not a powerful or logical explanation of the origins of the universe or life. And even Krauss's creative definition of nothing that exploded did nothing for me, literally, except provide a few laughs on late-night American TV. Gus seemed appalled that Christians would doubt some aspects of evolution or call it a lie, but even Krauss claimed in the movie that all views are subject to question, so that would include evolution in his invitation, I presume. And you go on in like manner. Thank you very much. You say, keep up the good work. I have to laugh when certain people email you and say you're slanted too much in a Christian way or you're somehow rude, as if. I think you made it quite clear it's a Christian radio show from the day one, and you've been quite respectful to all guests. Thank you very much indeed. Glad you enjoyed the programme too. Here's Philip Raymond, who says, sorry this is so long, but there were so many things wrong with Gus Holweder's argument that it needs a lengthy response. And just a reminder, Gus was the producer of the Unbelievers movie, who was in conversation with Graham Veal a couple of weeks ago. So here we go with Philip's email. You say, firstly, the atheist claim that because creationists reject evolution, they're rejecting science is nothing short of abject nonsense, and it's intellectually dishonest to put that argument. This alone shows that anyone making the claim has no credibility. Evolutionary scientists such as Alan Fiducia reject the claim that dinosaurs evolved into birds, but they aren't accused of rejecting science. The late Alton Harp and many other sciences rejected some of the claims of modern cosmology, but they weren't accused of rejecting science. Hoyle rejected the Big Bang, but wasn't accused of rejecting science. But if a creationary scientist rejects just the claims of what happened in the unobservable past, they are accused of rejecting science itself. And Gus' mention of Huxley and Wilberforce as evidence of religion holding back science is a case of rewriting history. In response, Graham pointed out that some theologians were accepting of it while some atheists objected. He could also have mentioned the scientists, including Pasteur, who rejected Darwin's views. Another example was the founder of the Melbourne Museum, where I come from. He rejected Darwin's views and did so on scientific grounds. Note, that's Melbourne, not Melbourne. Its pronunciation is one of the few things that Gus got right. I will note that for myself as well, Philip. Melbourne. Now, carrying on. Gus accused religion of claiming to know the answers, yet Dawkins and other atheists also claim to know the answers. They claim to know that evolution occurred, that religion is wrong, that the world is a few billion years old, etc. To pretend that only religion claims to know the answers is, again, intellectually dishonest. Further on in your email, you say Dawkins' claims about the number of atheists in Congress is illogical, because senators are not drawn randomly from the population, and his ridiculous claim that there must be atheists because they would be educated is just sheer bigotry. Justin, you referred to it as a tongue-in-cheek comment, but it was the only evidence he offered to support his ridiculous claim, so seemed to me to be a serious comment. It is, of course, easily disprovable, and Dawkins knows it. After all, one of the creationists he debated unsuccessfully many years ago had three times as many doctorates as Dawkins. Such comments show the depth to which some atheists will plummet in order to spread their propaganda. I don't think I'll have time to read everything here, as you anticipated, Philip. But thank you very much. Gus was sceptical. Finally, you say that a Christian would change his mind if presented with evidence for the non-existence of God, saying he'd believe it when he sees it. So has he never heard of all those atheists, including the ones who've been on Unbelievable, who claim that they were once Christians but changed their mind because of contrary evidence? Is he suggesting that they weren't really Christians to begin with? Interesting. OK, you had one last thing to add here, and it is a sort of criticism of the programme. You say my other big concern is Unbelievable's apparent reluctance to invite creationists onto the programme. And many people told you they wanted you to include creationists. You made a token gesture, but even then it seems that you only seem to think that they're fit to debate other Christians, not the atheistic evolutionists. Graham was clearly ill-equipped to answer those arguments, whereas a biblical creationist could have driven truck lorries through the holes in Gus's argument. Well, obviously, there's only time to do so many types of topics here on the show. And I do find in general it can be helpful, at least this is my view, to when you do a specifically creationist, young earth creationist kind of viewpoint, to have that as a debate between Christians, because obviously there is a variety of Christian view out there. That's not to say I wouldn't exclude the possibility of doing that with an atheist directly. As I'm sure you're aware, we did do last summer a couple of quite in-depth programs on young earth creationism with a theistic evolutionist. So thank you for getting in touch. Well, we've run out of time, as ever, on the programme. Another reminder that if you want to catch up on today's programme, find resources, link through to the Unbelievable Conference DVD and MP3 CD, all of that available from the website. You know what it is now, don't you? The new webpage for Unbelievable, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. I look forward to connecting with you on the social media sites as well, and look forward to hearing your thoughts on today's show. For the moment, let me tell you what's coming up next week. You're unbelievable. Well, I'm going to be joined again by Steve Maltz and Salim Munaya. They're going to be looking at the Jewishness of Jesus next week. And has the Western Church forgotten its Hebraic roots? And what about anti-Semitism as well in its history? All of that discussed next week here on the programme that aims to get you thinking. Hope you can join me again at the same time, same place. I'm Justin Brierley. Thank you for being with me on the programme today.